2. Scouts and Schooling. I joined Lord Baden-Powell's army of prepubescents, and it is an army, in the heyday of the Boy Scouts. In those days, we were truly legion. Some say there were close to 1 million UK scouts in the early 60s. A terrifying proposition if you imagine them all running at you across a field, or chanting Ging-Gang-Gooly again and again and again and again, but slightly louder each time. Even among such a vast number, I've stood out as quite an outstanding officer in the North Norwich district, HQ'd in Cottesley. I excelled at outdoor tasks, mastering knots that could, theoretically, lash a small boat to a jetty or splice together a child's shattered leg, identifying clues to help me track a stricken comrade, spotting dock leaves from 50 paces. But I was even more adept at the domestic chores that scouting taught. I could embroider badges onto the shirts of every scout who asked, and was an absolute whiz at buffing shoes, tying neckerchiefs, and adjusting woggles. I might as well admit now, before any member of my troop publishes a counter-memoir, that I never mastered firelighting. I admit that. I couldn't do fires. I could build them into sturdy wigwams of sticks and newspaper, no problem, but I found it very, very hard to make them catch fire. In fact, I still can't, which is why gas barbecues are such a blessed relief. I'm often asked, what do scouts do? Well, although highly trained and physically fit, scouts are not invited to defend Britain in an international conflict. Instead, much of our effort went into the production of our annual gang show, my first taste of showbiz. My aptitude for knot-tying meant that I was called into action as a stagehand, hoiking up scenery panels, then lowering them down again. I was good at it, and felt no real calling to be on stage, until the night of our first show. Scout leader Dave Millicent was MC, smartly dressed and with his hair parted to one side. He worked the crowd beautifully and introduced each term with a real panache. He was, in a very real sense, a presenter that night. And it was at the show's pinnacle as he queued up the backing track to Crest of a Wave and told them to take it away that I think I first knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to present. Many years later, I contacted Dave and asked him to co-present my show on hospital radio, but he said he didn't want to do it and didn't remember who I was. Still, he was a good man and a very talented scout. What most appealed to me about the scouts was that it was a true meritocracy. If you were diligent and resourceful and attended each week, you could orienteer your way to the very top. I'm proud to say I achieved the rank of patrol leader in no time, with 6 good scouts under my command. You'd think that this would automatically confer on me a bit of respect and obedience from others in the patrol. Sadly, many in the troop felt the scouting hierarchy only applied during our weekly meetings. One member of the troop, Phil Wiley, was in my class at school, and his behaviour towards me, a superior officer, was quite shameful. On one occasion he stole my swimming trunks, dropped them in a urinal, and laughed. This was in front of the whole class, many of whom were in my troop. Of course I couldn't let this slide, and I ordered him to rescue and wash them. He sniggered. I took a breath.
"Do as I say," I said calmly.
He began to walk away.
"Do as I say, Scout Wiley," I boomed.
"What did you call me? Scout Wiley?" He laughed again and indicated to the rest of the class that I was mentally defective by twirling a finger by the side of his head. Well, this was rank insubordination.
"Do as I say. I'm your patrol leader."
"Oh my God," he attempted weakly.
"I am your patrol leader. You are such a tit. I am your patrol leader. Fuck off."
He actually said that to me.
"I am your patrol leader. I am your patrol leader. I am your patrol leader. I am your patrol leader."
I continued to shout this until I was the only person left in the changing rooms. And then I fished my trunks from the well of piss with a fountain pen and showered them off for a few minutes before repeatedly hurling them against a wall to release the excess liquid. Yes, I'd had to save my trunks from someone else's urine, but I'd left my class colleagues certain of one thing. I was the patrol leader. The following week, I reported Wiley to Scout Leader Dave and was told not to tell tales, which didn't really bother me much at all. Wiley left the troop shortly after, and his schoolwork began to decline markedly. Without the discipline and brotherhood of the scouting movement, he drifted into a spiral of underachievement, culminating in his having sex with a lab technician. Because of pregnancy, she gave birth to a child, although Wiley has as close a relationship with it as you or I do. I treasured my involvement with the Scouts, of course I did. but it didn't compensate for the absence of love and affection I received in my home. That is a fact. Do you believe in guardian angels? I do. Not the winged ones you see in films, as I've often explained to my assistant, a Christian female. As well as being aerodynamically unfeasible, wings sprouting from the shoulder blades would pull the ribcage backwards and gradually suffocate the angel, a cause of death that's similar, ironically, to that of crucifixion. No, by guardian angels I mean nice people, and I do believe in them, although I reserve the right to be deeply suspicious of anyone who is unilaterally kind to me. My guardian angels were the Lambert family. They took me in when I had nowhere to go. They gave me food and shelter, and love when my own parents had deserted me. I remain forever in your debt, although not in any legal sense. I was temporarily fostered by this kindly family in 1961. As family friends who were friends with our family, theirs was a loving home, and I stayed for more than 3 weeks, returning home only because Mum and Dad had come back from their holiday in Brittany, and it was time to go. This was the first time I'd experienced the warmth of a caring family. Not for them, the bickering over VAT receipts, or making their children pick up privet cuttings in the rain. Instead, I was treated like a human being. The father, Trevor, was an asthmatic, but what he lacked in being able to breathe quietly, he more than made up for with his parental skills. He always found time to not hit his children, and I remember thinking that was tremendous. "Got to say, Trevor," I remember announcing on my second day there, "you have a wonderful way with your kids. You're a credit to yourself. I, for one, am impressed." "Thanks, Alan," he said. "Yes, that's lovely of you, Alan." I turned to see Mother Lambert, better known as Fran, handing out fresh milk and cooked cookies to her three children, Kenneth, Emma, and Sheila. The children were marginally older than I was, and remain so to this day. But they reached across the age divide to show me friendship and goodwill. But it was Fran who was the chief supplier of love. From day one, I was clasped to her bosom. Not literally. Not literally at all. There was no suggestion of any sordid behaviour. Please don't think there was, just because I've created the image of my face being pulled towards an older woman's breasts. I don't want you to take away even a residual inkling that the family was marred by a proclivity for child molestation. In fact, I'm in two minds about whether to keep this paragraph in at all, in case the denial of any wrongdoing makes you think there's something that needs denying. There isn't. They were a lovely family, kept themselves to themselves, and the neighbours have said they seemed perfectly normal. Actually, that makes them sound worse. I was happy there, and saw no reason why I couldn't stay among the Lamberts for the rest of my life. But the nature and length of my stay there hadn't been adequately explained to me. And so it was, one cold summer's morning, I looked up from a genuinely difficult jigsaw puzzle to see my mother and father standing there, my coat in Mum's hands. I burst into tears. The Lamberts cried too, inwardly, as they waved me off. Mum and Dad thanked their counterparts. "Say thank you, Alan," Mum said. "Thank you," I snivelled. "Don't mention it," said Trevor Lambert. "You can come and stay any time you like." I stopped crying. "Pardon? Come and stay any time you like." And with that, I was driven away. But my life had been touched by guardian angels, their kindness ringing in my ears like chronic tinnitus. I pressed my hand against the window like they do in films. And at this point, the director might like to do a slow fade to black. "Smelly Alan Fartridge! Smelly Alan Fartridge!" The words spewed from my classmates' mouths like invisible projectile sick, landing in my ears and ending up caked all over my shattered self-esteem. My inner confidence must have reeked. Short of doing me in with a blade, it wasn't that sort of school. There was nothing these educationally slow children could have done to hurt me more. But still they shouted, "Smelly Alan Fartridge! Smelly Alan Fartridge! He loves his mum. He lives in her bum. You think that's bad? You should smell his dad. Smelly Alan Fartridge!" It was agony on so many levels. For starters, they were bellowing over the sound of English teacher Mr. Bevin, academically suicidal given that mock exams were just weeks away, and a personal affront to Mr. Bevin, who, although timid and stuttering, knew his onions English-wise. For mains, it was the dunder-headed wrongness of what they were saying. I did not smell. I was a keen cleanser, diligently showering each day and making sure that my body, private's face, and mouth were stench and stain-free. If I smelt of anything, it would have been Matey, now Radox, and Colgate. And for afters, their catcalls were a depressing reminder of my own father's suffering. Having signed up to the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Norfolk Regiment in World War II, for my money, the Great War, he learned that a sloppy administrator had spelt his surname Prattridge. The consequent teasing and name-calling he received at the hands of his compatriots cut him deep. The horror of war, up there with trench foot and being attacked with guns. Smelly Alan Fartridge. Say it to yourself a few times. Pretty annoying, isn't it? About 3% as clever as it thinks it is. A piece of infantile wordplay that most right-minded abusers would dismiss as rubbish, but which a small minority of backward Norfolk underachievers repeated again and again and again and again. They were led by one child, whose name I can barely even remember. In fact, his name was Stephen McComb. You won't even be able to tell, but I had to think for ages then between the words name and was, so insignificant is he in the roll call of people I've encountered. McComb, let's not bother with first names, was and is, I'm sure, a grade A dumbo. He could afford to lark around in class, so certain was his fate as a manual worker. The kind who'd never have cause to rely on school teachings, unless it was for the tie-break round of a pub quiz, where the top prize is some meat. McComb didn't just squawk Smelly Alan Fartridge at me a few times. His was a campaign of petty abuse that was awesome in its length and breadth. Between 1962 and 1970, McComb, and again, these are events that bother me so little, my brain has them filed under Forget If You Like, waged an impressive, consistent war on me. This frenzied attack on me and my rights took several sickening forms. He stole, interfered with, and returned my sandwiches. He mimicked my voice when I effortlessly answered questions in class. He removed my shorts on a cross-country run and ran off fast. He reacted hysterically when I referred to a teacher as Mum. He threw my bat and ball into a canal. He spat on my back. He daubed grotesque sexual images on my freshly wallpapered exercise books and, in a sinister twist, he tracked the progress of my puberty, making unflattering comparisons to his own and to the majority of my classmates. This was psychological torment that few could have withstood. I withstood it. One day, I decided enough was enough, so I plucked up the courage to confront him for an almighty showdown. It was 5 p.m. on a wet Tuesday, and I took a deep breath and went for it. "Oi," I said. "McComb." He hesitated. "What?" "Watch it, mate." A pause. The guy was rattled. "What?" I said, "Watch it. Watch what you say and watch how you say it, you snivelling little goose. You might find you've pushed someone too far one day and they will unleash hell in your face." "What?" "Stop saying what. Listen to me. You're going to start showing me a bit of respect, buddy boy, or you will reap a whirlwind. The days of infantile name-calling and sexually explicit graffiti are over. It stops, right?" "What? I can't hear you, mate." "I'm not your mate." "What?" This was infuriating. I unwrapped my jumper from the mouthpiece. Oh, I forgot to say, this was on the phone. "Just watch it, McComb." "Who is this?" "See you around." "Is this Partridge?" I hung up, my point made. My parting shot, "See you around," had sounded particularly menacing. I would have said "see you in school," but we'd both left a few years before, and "around" sounded more threatening anyway. McComb had left school at the first opportunity. His mindless decision-making conducted almost entirely by a hormone-addled penis, so desperate to impregnate the first chubby cashier it could slip into. Sure enough, McComb and Janice have a litter of 4 children, not much younger than they are. Way to go, guys. McComb worked for several years in the warehouse of British Leyland before a back injury scuppered his forklift truck driving. He now lives on disability allowance in Edgbaston and has gained a lot of weight. No prizes for guessing which of us is the smelly one now. Interestingly, McComb's career-ending back complaint is so cripplingly debilitating he can only manage the 3 games of 10-pin bowling per week, a fact that may or may not have been documented and photographed by my assistant. The dossier may or may not have been passed on to Birmingham City Council, and I may or may not be waiting for a reply, although this is the public sector, so I shan't be holding my breath. The divergence between our 2 lives, mine successful, his pathetic, is best illustrated in our choice of garden furnishings. I've enhanced my lawn with a rockery. McComb has chosen a broken washing machine. And what a pair he and Janice make. I spoke with her once when she asked me what I was doing outside their house, and her language was appalling, a very aggressive woman. McComb rarely, if ever, strays into my consciousness now, but in some ways I thank him. the ribbing that he orchestrated, and to be fair, there were probably others involved too, Andy Bendel, Joe Cowes, Alan Rolland, Richard Toms, Justin Parker, Noel Scott and Daniel Groves, has given me a thick skin that has served me well. I grew a teak-tough, metaphorically bulletproof hide essential in the very real war zone that is broadcasting. I could give you three examples right now of the times that the smelly Alan Fartridge barbs have stood me in good stead. When Bridie McMahon, failed TV presenter who you won't have heard of, pointed out on air that an anagram of Alan Partridge is anal dirge prat. Sure, I wanted to shove her in the face, but I had the self-discipline not to. When formerly significant TV critic Victor Lewis Smith described my military-based quiz show Skirmish as a thick man's Takeshi's Castle, I wanted to hurt him physically, but I had the restraint not to. I just left 60 abusive voicemails on his mobile, plus 12 on Valerie Singleton's, for which I've apologised. She's above him in my contacts list. There's probably a third example, too, but the point is, the inane taunts from my school days have given me strength and perspective. An addendum. In 1994, I was named TV Quick's Man of the Moment. At the same time, McComb contracted glandular fever. Needless to say, McComb, I had the last laugh, and I'm still having it.